once I figure that out, then Bill's parts sort of all lined up for me and they started to make sense. And I started working on them, and I had to come to a place where I had to realize, even after all that work, I'm still not Bill. And I had to play the parts in a way that paid tribute to the parts, but I still was going to play them like I played them, because it's me.
Hello and welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. I am your co-host, Pepper. As with me, as always, Kevin McCracken. Kevin McCracken, how are you? And who's with us today?
Brooks Harlan is with us, and I am very excited to actually meet him because we haven't met previously, and talk to him about all of the... He's sort of a Renaissance man, Brooks. He's got... not only is he writing music, he's producing for other people, as well as he's got, looks like a repair shop for old amplifiers. So that's pretty incredible. And so welcome, Brooks. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for dealing with all my technical difficulties this morning.
It's always a battle. Brooks, where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in El Paso, Texas. And I grew up there, I guess you could say. I lived there till I was just after my 18th birthday. I moved to go to college. So that's where I grew up.
Were you doing a lot of music when you were a kid and stuff? How did you kind of get into this world?
Yeah, I was always a musical kid. My family had a piano in the house that was sort of a family heirloom that I guess my mom had also played on when she was young. So that was around the house, and I was always picking out tunes on the piano. I took piano lessons in grade school. And then I joined band in sixth grade.
So you were a cool kid.
I don't know if that would be cool, but I played French horn in school band starting in sixth grade. So I've always been surrounded by music. My father was a singer. He did some opera singing, and so there was always music in the house. I was always drawn to music, and there was never really a question in my mind that I was going to do something involved, that involved music.
Amazing. That's interesting to know that, or have feel that kind of purpose at such a young age. I think a lot of people don't have any idea what they want to do.
I still don't have any idea what I want to do. So Brooks, El Paso had, did you get into the punk scene in El Paso? Were you playing in punk bands there when you were a kid? Like, how did that come about?
You know, starting like most kids my age, starting about 13 years old, we discovered skateboarding and BMX biking. Yeah. And through that, we discovered punk bands. I started playing guitar around then because I already knew music, so I just had to figure out how to sort of translate it to another instrument. My best friend that I grew up with, Jim Ward, who went on to be in At the Drive-In and Sparta and et cetera.
Sure.
He and I sort of picked up guitar. He played bass because his father had a bass guitar around, and we started writing songs at probably 13 or 14.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
When did you actually start playing live? Like, when did that step?
Probably, and unfortunately, around that same time. You know, El Paso is a pretty small city, and any scene there is pretty small, but especially like kids that were into the music we were into. Yeah. So it was pretty easy to get a show. And El Paso is a pretty temperate climate.
Right.
It's pretty warm most of the time. So there's a lot of outdoor shows. Kids have shows in their backyard. So, you know, it's easy to ask your buddy if you can play the show and just show up
and just jump on stage.
That's kind of when I started playing
rock. So it was like just a thriving little local scene. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody's booking everybody.
Everybody definitely knew everybody. And what was great is that, you know, every band was a little different. You know, there was the band that sounded like the Misfits, and there was the band that sounded like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and there was the band that sounded like Crass. And but they would all play shows together, and it was great, you know. So I sort of, and to this day, I enjoy shows where the bands are varied, and your ears don't get tired of, you know, 12 bands that sound like the headliner.
Yeah, it's always good to have a mix. Mm-hmm. I feel like I played a show in El Paso in like 1991 or 92 at the college there. An outdoor show. And I know it was like, that was the only place that we could play. Cause or somebody's backyard, because that band only played all ages shows, but we played like right in the middle of the, like whatever the quad area or whatever they called it, the outdoor sort of like student. I was in the band Engage. I don't know.
Do you remember who you played with?
Yeah.
But there was actually a fair amount of kids there. It was like a really good show. They all bought 7 inches and t-shirts, and it kind of fueled us to our next stop, which was Dallas. You know, like the kids were into it, and we weren't like the most accessible band either.
Yeah. Well, that's why, I mean, just like you said, you were on your way to Dallas, right? So El Paso, got a lot of bands that were either on their way to LA one direction or on their way to Dallas the other direction. And that really formed the type of scene that we had there. So there were a lot of Discord bands that came through from the East. There were a lot of like Southern California bands that came through from the West. And so, you know, we saw a surprisingly high caliber of shows because of the location of El Paso. And so the scene wasn't very large as far as number of kids, but the shows that we got were pretty great. And that's, you know, the few bands that came out of El Paso, it's pretty evident like what their influences were. And yeah, it's because of its location. And I didn't really realize how unique that was until I was out of that environment and sort of looked back on it.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's kind of like how we were both Pepper and I are from Sonoma County out here, and we had the Phoenix Theater in Petaluma, and we were kind of the middle spot between people going to Gilman Street and then Oregon or Humboldt, right? Like, okay, we're going to play one more show in the Bay Area-ish. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be at the Phoenix Theater. So we got, you know, we had Fugazi play there. We had, you know, Green Day when they were kind of coming up, play there a ton of times. I mean,
every weekend.
Yeah, pretty much. But it was, you know, it was like, that was because we were in that proximity to the Bay Area, but it was far enough away that they could get a different crowd, right?
Yeah. You know what feels different about it to me, Kevin? And I don't know if it is or not, is our scene was very connected to other scenes.
Yeah,
it felt very connected to the East Bay mostly, but also Chicago and some other places. And I wonder, Brooks, if your scene felt connected to other scenes, or it just felt like its own thing.
I don't know. You know, El Paso is very isolated. You know, the closest sort of bigger-ish city is Albuquerque, and that's a 5-6 hour drive.
Right.
Lubbock, where I went to college, is a 6 hour drive. Dallas is much further than that. Yeah, yeah. So I think the scene had its own flavor because of, like I said, the types of different bands that would come through, and those sort of got mixed up in a weird pot of the unique culture that is El Paso, which is very border town. You know, Juarez, which is right across the border, and El Paso are basically one big city separated by an international border. And so you throw that in the mix, and there was sort of the gang culture of, like, you know, the sort of lower income areas of the town. That was also mixed up in the scene. So there were, like, skater gangs, and it was really unique. And but I also feel like, because of who we were all influenced by, I think we really had some talented people come out of that scene, and sort of the friendships that I had there have lasted to this day for the most part.
Amazing.
And
and then you left.
Yeah.
To go to college.
And then
so,
I left.
So where did you go to college? Where did you move on to?
Yeah. Well, I think like most young people, I needed to spread my wings, and I definitely didn't appreciate El Paso when I was there because it represented me being young and I wanted to go do my own thing. So I went to music school at Texas Tech University. I studied theory and composition. So I was there for 4 years. I got my degree. And that's when I left. And that was, I graduated in 1994.
Mm-hmm. Were you playing in bands in college or just doing college?
Yeah. So I sort of had this parallel track, or I guess parallel tracks of my music education, my punk rock life, and then sort of my technical engineering life, which was also sort of happening at that time. Mm-hmm. I was a busy kid. I didn't sleep a lot.
Sounds like it.
That's incredible. I mean, that just like, it feels like such a punk rock story too, because it feels so like organic and kind of you created your own path with all of it. And what kind of, after you were done with Texas Tech, what was your next stop? Where did you go?
So, at that point I was married. I got married in college.
Okay.
Pretty young.
Aww.
I lived in North Texas for like a year and a half after that, 'cause I wasn't really sure. I sort of half-heartedly applied to grad schools, but I didn't really have the passion to continue my education at that point. And I was in some touring, a touring band at that time, and I kind of wanted to give it a shot right after college. So I sort of went to a place where my then wife's family lived, so that when I was gone, she wasn't like alone, basically. And so then pretty quickly after, I think it was there for a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years, moved to Baltimore at that point. And that was in early 2000.
What's Baltimore like?
Baltimore's great.
Is that where you still are?
Baltimore has four seasons, which I enjoy. Baltimore, it's weird to say this, but the things that I liked about El Paso, Baltimore sort of has that, but wrapped in a coating of East Coast city, right? So the scene is actually not that big. Everybody knows everybody. But it's the southernmost East Coast city that still has sort of that classic East Coast downtown, you know, that you see in Philly and Boston and New York. And
magical.
I love that stuff. And I've one of the reasons I left Texas is because, well, quite a few reasons, but I just really liked this mid-Atlantic area. When I was touring around the country, I would always really enjoy being in this area. And so it just drew me in. And I've been here longer than anywhere now. If I moved here in 2000, then that's 23 years ago.
Oh, wow.
It feels very much like home. And, mm-hmm. I pretty quickly got a live sound gig. I do front of house engineering. And, I worked at a club here for almost 20 years straight as the house sound engineer.
That is awesome.
I never hear Baltimore.
Feel pretty comfortable here.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and having the same I would guess that they understand that you're also a touring musician, so they allow you that sort of freedom to do what you need to do for yourself too. I mean, one of my close friends is front of house, one of the lead engineers at Bottom of the Hill here in San Francisco. And he runs like a dog rescue as well. And he makes the schedule. So he can give himself whatever schedules he needs. And they're super flexible about it.
Right. I think it's, most of the time I was working there, there was like me and two or three other people that would rotate. And we were all involved in playing music, touring as musicians, touring as sound people, touring as backline technicians. So it's sort of understood that that's part of your life and your job. And
I would expect that's a huge benefit too for the club, having somebody that actually tours and is like probably very picky about sound.
Yeah, that's true. I think, with live sound, really it's experience. And, after working in that same room for so long, it just became second nature. And, I guess touring too, getting to hear different rooms, different systems helps. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to agree.
This may be, I don't know if
it is beneficial.
I don't want to put you on the spot. So don't answer this if you can't think of something, but is there something you would have told yourself on your first day doing that, like a trick or something that would have saved you a lot of time with live sound that you've learned over the years?
I think the trick is that as long as everyone can hear the vocals, then don't worry about, don't get bogged down in like, oh, what's my compression ratio on the kick drum? Like nobody actually cares about that. What they care about is, can they hear the guy singing their favorite song? And if you got that going, then you can work on everything else as the show progresses and you're going to be okay.
Awesome. Thanks.
That is awesome. So, you have an extensive kind of resume when it comes to playing in bands, but let's talk about some of the ones that you're like still playing in and been more focused on, and most specifically War on Women. I'd love to hear sort of the backstory on how you all got together. I mean, and just in all, in transparency, I've seen you play live. I've also seen you play in Jawbox. War on Women is a pretty lively, lively live show. I mean, you guys rock. I mean, it's like no joke. And I, I say that without any bit of like irony. I mean, it's an incredibly energetic live show. And I'd love to just kind of hear how you all kind of came together. I know there's been some membership changes over the years, but it seems like it's been pretty solid the last few. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Our goal is to rock, so I appreciate the compliment. War on Women is it's a band that I think the we first started writing songs for that band in 2010, so it's now a 13-year-old project, which is pretty wild to say out loud. And it sort of came from, so Shauna, the singer, and I were in a band previous that was called Avec, and it was very of the 2000s. It was like indie rock with very poetic, veiled lyrics, and we did that whole thing, and we toured in that band for years and tried everything we could to make anybody care about us, and they didn't, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I'm proud of those records, and we were just looking for something that was a little more raw and a little more in your face. And Shauna at the time was really coming into her own as an activist and as a feminist, and I was sort of realizing that I was good enough at guitar that I could actually play songs that I would have liked to play when I was in high school.
Oh, cool.
And so, so when I was in high school, I was really into, early high school was like metal stuff, Slayer, Metallica. And, you know, through skateboarding, I got into Misfits and Minor Threat and Bad Brains. And yeah. To this day, I still love those bands. And if you listen to War on Women riffs, like, it's very apparent that all the bands I just mentioned are influential on my guitar playing. And so I was like, let's just write some songs, like just throw some stuff out there. And before we knew it, we got invited to play our friend Dana's birthday party. And so we sort of filled out the band with drummer, bass player. And then that was our goal, right? To play this birthday party. So if that's your goal as a band, anything on top of that just seems like an incredible bonus. So starting from there, we just kept getting show offers and tour offers and offers to put out records. And so it was great. But it was also ironic because we had worked so hard at our previous band for nothing. And this band, War on Women, that we kind of threw together was getting all these opportunities. But then at some point you realize, well, you know, we actually are working on this band, and
yeah,
you know, we actually did put a lot into writing these songs, and
is there a sunken
band has just been very,
would you describe it as like a sunk,
very fortunate
artistic sunken cost fallacy? Because I've found like when I work hardest on songs, they're like not as good as the ones that just like, you know, come from the sky.
Ooh, see.
And I don't want to let go of them because I work so hard on them.
I don't know. I think there's a balance. And if you listen to a War on Women record, you definitely hear the songs that we threw together in 10 minutes in the rehearsal space. And you definitely can hear the songs that took me 2 months to piece together.
Sure.
So that's kind of the story of the band. You know, we have an EP 10 inch out and 3 full lengths, and we are currently writing the next full length.
Yay.
That's bananas. So how long have you guys been together now? What's the history? Like what's the time?
Yeah. So we started in 2010. So we've been a band for 13 years. Yeah, it's been a very fortunate 13 years, and yes, we've had some member changes because we're adults and trying to be in a touring band, and it's hard.
Sure.
Yeah. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's why I gave up that part of my life, 'cause I'm doing other stuff that's, I wouldn't say more fulfilling, but it's more in line with my, personal life.
Yeah, I hear that. And to be quite frank, I thought I had given that up too. Like the previous band to War on Women, Avec, we were sort of burned out on the whole thing. We were burned out on touring. We were burned out on dealing with record labels and promoters and all that crap. And so, you know, around 2010, I was kind of like, okay, like it's time to transition into my stay at home adult life. And I was fine with that. So like I said, everything has been a surprise and an icing on the cake for that band.
That's amazing. Well, so talking about personal life. So what is your sort of like, what does a day look like in your life when you're home? Like, what do you like? I know you do live sound. Looks like you've got this like repair business as well. How, what do you, other than rehearsing, what are you doing at home or practicing, as Mike Watt likes to say?
Yeah. Well, so my current life, so I've stepped away from sound engineering quite a bit, because my, well, two reasons. We had, I don't know if you've heard about this global pandemic that happened, but
wait a minute.
That was tough on the live sound and live music industry. But also around that time, I sort of made a decision to devote more time to the repair shop because it was getting sort of out of control busy. And I did have some employees, and one of them moved. And then due to the pandemic, I had to sort of slim down the staff because I couldn't pay anyone. Sure. So, so now my typical day is, I will wake up, try and do something physical. I'll go to the gym, go for a jog. It's kind of a thing I've found necessary to sort of stabilize my mental, the state of my mind. Then I'll go into the shop, work all day, come home, work on music, watch something cool on TV, and then go to bed.
What are we watching?
Oh, well, I just finished a really great show. It's a Korean, I guess you would call it a game show, but it's a physical 100 where they get 100 really strong people and make them compete against each other. And people slowly get eliminated until they're down to one person who's like, has the best physique in Korea. It was an incredible show. I'm actually watching it again.
Whoa. Wow. I think that is it on Netflix, because I think it popped up on my
something
you might like kind of list.
It is on Netflix. Yeah.
This is what the show is really about.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
This is what the podcast is really about.
Like, what are you doing now?
It made me.
It's all about what time do you wake up and what are you watching.
It made me feel really out of shape, but the spirit of the show is just fantastic.
So you're recording or you're writing music right now for War on Women.
Yeah, for War on Women, we are in the process of writing the next full length record.
Do you bring a song in? Oh, no, yeah, I guess you already described how it works. I was going to ask if you show up with a song and kind of learn it together, like that style, most often.
It depends. It depends. Like sometimes I'll have a song just finished, like top to bottom, and I'll bring it in and, you know, we'll work on it as a band and maybe work on transitions or lengthen the part or shorten a part as needed. Other times we'll just, somebody will have a drum fill idea, and then that will spring into a whole song in rehearsal. So I wouldn't say there's one set.
Sure. I was just going to ask, do you write your songs on an electric guitar or acoustic guitar?
I would say 90% of the time I write it on electric guitar, knowing that it will eventually be played on electric guitar. Songs I've written on acoustic are simply by accident, just because I happen to have an acoustic and then I come up with an idea and think, well, that might sound good for War on Women. I've had bad luck trying to write And I actually write on a guitar that's plugged into some sort of amplifier simulator.
Oh, wow.
The reason, like I said, you know, I know that eventually it will be performed on an electric guitar. Mm-hmm. And I've had bad experience of writing on a guitar that isn't plugged in. And I think it sounds great. And then I'll go and plug in my amp and it's mushy or, you know, for whatever reason, like I've put too many notes in the chord and it's confusing. So.
All right. Can I ask you one more songwriting question?
That's kind of how I try to write. Of course.
Do you tend to write songs in the same key that to help the vocals? Like if you know the vocals tend to be better in one key, do you stick to that key or do you shift around?
Mm. Interesting question. So historically in War and Women, I would say no. And I try and make a, because I'm a music theory nerd. I try and vary the keys that War and Women songs are in. So it doesn't sound so static.
Mm-hmm.
And I go through phases of like, sometimes I really like C sharp minor and sometimes I really like, you know, F Phrygian or whatever, and I'll try and write a set of songs in that mode. But I will say on this record, the thing that we're doing slightly different is Shauna is actually coming in with more vocal ideas earlier on in the songwriting process. So we're able to take the songs and sort of twist them or mold them around the vocal ideas more than we have in the past. And so I think this record is going to be different in that way, where it's a little more vocally and lyrically driven versus our previous records, where it's just kind of like, here's a riff and here's Shauna singing over that riff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing. That's very exciting. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, me too. That sounds awesome.
Me too.
Kevin, I think we got to wrap pretty soon.
Pretty soon. I do want to get into, I have like a couple posters from the shows you guys played with Jawbreaker, because at the time I was doing their merch still. And
cool.
There's some of my GarageLand put them together. They're some of my favorite like band posters. I don't really hang band posters that much anymore because my wife's not too keen on me, you know, doing that. But they're just beautifully printed and just really cool designs. So I couldn't help it as an old screen printer.
Yeah, I remember those posters. They're great.
Got to keep one of these, you know. So how did the Jawbox thing come together? Well, I mean, I know how it happened as far as them and you know, the parting of ways. How did you end up kind of coming into the band, and what's that been like playing with them? I mean, it's
right. I'll try and be brief. I've known Jay for quite a while. Most of the time I've lived in Baltimore, I knew Jay and we sort of ran into each other at shows, and we were both recording engineers, and he and I have just always got along well, and I feel like we have similar sensibilities and similar tastes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I played bass in the band Office of Future Plans with him, and I'm currently still in the Jay Robbins band playing bass. So he and I have collaborated quite a bit. I also did a tour and a few shows with the Jay Robbins Acoustic, where I played a keyboard and a baritone guitar, which was fun.
Oh,
so nice. I'm always, you know, I'm always like, whatever you need me to fill in on Jay, I'm here. I've been a Jay Robbins / Jawbox fan for a long time, like a lot of people my age in the scene. And you know, to be honest, Jawbox was a band that I heard at a time when I was mostly into just hardcore music. And as someone who was a fan of classical music and jazz, I could hear other stuff happening in the music that was sort of being injected under the umbrella of like DC hardcore punk, whatever you want to call that era of like late 80s, early 90s Discord music. And so Jawbox quickly rose to the top of my favorite bands from the Discord catalog. When Bill decided to leave the band, it was funny. Jay sort of casually asked me if I would be interested. And so I casually tried to reply, yes, I'm interested. And so then I started working on the songs for basically the idea was that Jawbox had committed to a certain amount of shows that were interrupted by the pandemic. So post pandemic, they were going to fulfill those commitments and I was going to fill in for Bill on guitar. And so I needed to learn the songs to play. And that was my initial goal.
Is that hard?
So that's how it happened.
Amazing.
Was it hard? Because I'm
well.
You can't like just Google the chord.
I'll say. Exactly. So I'll say first off, Bill Barbeau was very gracious and very friendly, and I sent him a message right off the bat and just was like, you know, basically it's a real honor to learn these parts and play these parts that were written by you. And he got back to me and he was like, seemed happy for me and he was giving me his blessing to continue. And that was a really good feeling. And it was really important to me to know that. So I started working on the songs and I immediately found out that I think all the Jawbox guitar parts that I had been drawn to were more the Jay Robbins guitar parts. And so listening to Bill's parts, I realized that he and I are very different players. Like the way he approaches guitar or the voicings of the chords or even the way he grabs the neck is just different than me. So the first thing I had to do is sort of crack the code of how Bill approached guitar. And I tried my best to sort of get in that mindset. And then once I sort of figured out that, and sort of learned the little, I mean, when I say guitar tricks, I'm not by any means putting down Bill's guitar playing. Every guitar player has a guitar trick that they use. And so once I figured that out, then Bill's parts sort of all lined up for me and they started to make sense. And I started working on them and I had to come to a place where I had to realize even after all that work, I'm still not Bill. And I had to play the parts in a way that paid tribute to the parts, but I still was going to play them like I played them because it's me. And so once I got to that point, then I really got to work and, you know, I had to learn about, I think eventually I learned 33 or 34 songs pretty quickly. And, and I had to come up with a way of like quickly notating them because I was learning a song and how to play it. And then I had to move on to another song. So I had to come up with a way to quickly notate it so I could come back to it and remember how I learned it. So that was kind of how I approached it. And then once we got closer to some event like, okay, we're going to do these Jawbreaker shows on the West Coast. These are the songs that are going to be in rotation. Then I could work then I could put more work into the ones that would be in that set list or in that group of songs. And that's kind of how it went. And then on top of that, I realized I had to actually sing Bill's vocals on songs. And that was actually the thing that I was, that I had the most anxiety about, because
yeah,
even more so, my voice doesn't sound like Bill. And
right.
I don't really consider myself a very good singer and or a very good at remembering lyrics. Like, so that was the thing I had to work the most on. And the way I did that is when War on Women in the fall of 2021, we did a 5-week tour with Bad Religion and Alkaline Trio. And I did a lot of the driving on that record. I mean, on that tour. And so I would just play the Jawbox songs. Mm. I was up in the cab of this bandwagon we took on tour, and I would just play the songs and just sing all the backup parts to all the songs, go through the whole playlist, and then start it over. So I did 5 weeks of rehearsing, and that finally got me ready to do all that. So
that's incredible.
That's how I prepared.
You did great.
Thank you.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, the Fillmore shows were incredible. I was at, I think, all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you guys sounded great. Let me ask too. I'm a drummer.
I remember those shows. I felt good about those shows.
They sounded fantastic. I mean, I did the wander around. I was just to kind of hear how the sound was in different parts of the venue, and you guys sounded incredible. I had seen Jawbox a number of times, like going back to the original, you know, before they took their extended break, before you guys got together. It just sounded great. It was a very, in fact, the whole energy of those shows was really good all the way around. Mm-hmm. And the Fillmore is one of those places. If you're not really bringing it, the crowd there will be very quiet, you know? So it was awesome. It was a really fun few nights.
So Team Dresch opened those shows and,
yes,
they're one of my favorite bands, and the fact that just getting to see them play is always a treat. But the fact that I got to know them, and it was just like, that was the highlight of my year. I mean, I loved playing in Jawbox. I loved seeing Jawbreaker, but just hanging out with the Team Dresch people and seeing them play, that was like, that was such a treat for me.
They were incredible too. I mean, they just sounded great. It was just a great.
Those were special nights.
It was like the greatest show of 1997.
Exactly. Well, I think everybody's improved since then. What's it like to be on stage with Zach as well? I mean, he's insane.
Zach, as you know, is a very unique drummer. Yeah. And, I really enjoy playing with Zach because he really brings a lot of energy, and I was a little unsure about getting used to his style because that's the way it is with drummers, and every drummer I've played with is slightly different, and it takes you a minute to sort of lock in. But with Zach, for some reason, I'm able to read his body language really well. And so just from right away, like first rehearsal, I was like, oh, like this is how it's going to be. And I never thought about it again.
Nice.
I feel like he has a good way of he has a good way of leading you to where you're going. Mm-hmm. And it might be different from night to night, but you still feel comfortable, like you know what's happening,
mm-hmm.
Right. Which is great.
Like a conductor.
Yeah. Yep. So we are running out of time here, Brooks, but I have to say it was a pleasure talking to you. And I look forward to the new War on Women record. It just sounds like the writing process is just in a really unique place. And, you know, and just taking the time.
Well, thank
and
you. With all the thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And so we just released Jay's episode today, And so we will have, we'll probably try to get this edited and up next week, actually, so that we just complete the Jawbox series all at once. So I'll send you some social media stuff and just things that you can use. But let us know too, you know, if you have any questions about the interview. But I really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks.
Oh well, it's no problem. I'm happy to do it, and I appreciate your questions. And I apologize if the technical issues were on my end, but
everything's going to sound great.
I think you should have something in there you can salvage.
It's going to be fantastic. And thank you everybody for listening. We will see you next week.